Hello, everyone. This is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. A couple of months ago, ESA instated a commercial director amongst its council of 11 directors. Agenda 2025 put a very strong and clear focus on commercialization as one of the top priorities of the space agency. But what does all this mean? Geraldine Nadja is the new director and knows more.
Hi, Marcus. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I don't hear you so well.
I need a microphone.
Ah, that's much better.
And of course,
no, that's better.
As you may have guessed, we took unexpected detours with this conversation and touched upon some unusual topics, like what it takes to make an ESA director cry.
Could you use your smartphone also to record everything in a voice memo?
So then I can sue you if you say nasty things about me.
Exactly. Yeah. Now only Americans do that.
Welcome, Geraldine Nadja, to our cozy coffee parlor.
I have a cup of tea, but I don't have a space cup, as you see. I have a teddy bear, rather. Okay, so my name is Geraldine Nadja. I'm an engineer by background, and I studied political studies as well. I work at ESA for a long, long time. I joined ESA just after my studies, and I did several functions at ESA, from a young engineer, then strategy, EU relations, launchers, space station, you name it. And now I'm the director for commercialization, industry, and procurement since last October.
Wow.
And why I do what I do is because actually commercialization has become a high priority for ESA since last year when we have a new DG who joined in and defined five priorities for ESA. And also, I think because the overall space context dictates that commercialization be an important objective. So that's why I'm doing it. It's a new function at ESA. It's a new directorate, and I'm very happy to do it.
Wonderful. The new directorate, all being headed by an Austrian director general, I'm very proud of, being an Austrian myself. So is he doing a good job?
Oh, he's doing a great job. And by the way, I'm 25% Austrian, so I have an Austrian grandmother, so I'm very pleased to.
Nice. So shall we speak in German then, or Austrian?
Ein wenig, aber nicht genug.
Okay, wonderful. Geraldine, why is the space industry interesting to you in the first place?
Well, the space industry is at the heart of what we do. Our job is to really develop missions, infrastructure, satellites, you name it. And to do that, we are the managers, but we are not the developers. So space industry is crucial for us so that our, let's say, our ambitions, our dreams become true hardware that flies, that goes to space, and that delivers the services or the data that we expect. So I think ESA is, ESA's partnership with industry is central for all that we do. And by the way, before I was in charge of commercialization and became a director, I was in charge of industrial policy. So indeed, in the last 6 years, I have worked very closely with industry and with industry of all sides, because the industrial ecosystem in Europe is extremely diverse. You have large system integrators, you have mid-caps, you have SMEs, you have now many startups. You have also academia. So it's very diverse, and all this diversity is needed to make the ambitions and the dreams become missions.
If you could choose now between different kinds of industries, maybe the automotive industry or the space industry or whatnot industry, why is the space industry special to you personally?
Well, first of all, I'm a space fan. And okay. I've always been.
That's a good start.
As I said, I joined ESA just after my study. At that time, I joined on the space station program, which was still paper. Now you have astronauts, you have Matthias Maurer, you will have Samantha flying in the space station. So it's extremely fascinating to see something that you contributed to design become a real infrastructure. But more than that, I think space is really the most interesting questions that we ask ourselves. I mean, it's about who we are, why are we here, how does the universe, how was the universe born, why did we have life, etc. So I was always passionate about space. And I think what is very specific to space industry is that, first of all, until recently, should I say, it was an industry of prototypes. In a way, we were doing only Formula One cars. Mm-hmm. And we were doing the most beautiful cars, or mm-hmm. to use this example, mm-hmm. and the most advanced ones. So it's a very high-tech industry where most of the things only fly once. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mean rockets here. I don't mm-hmm. mean launchers. But if you look at when we do scientific missions, we go once to the comet. We go once to study the moons on Saturn or Jupiter. So each time it's a completely new thing that we build from scratch. We have no precedent on which mm-hmm. to build our infrastructure. Now, of course, all this has changed. And now we see the new space movement mm-hmm. where we see the development of lots of little series of satellites, of constellations, mm-hmm. of small satellites, and of course, launchers, which are designed in a high number of elements. So now this is completely different. But still, there remains the high-tech, the risky business, because risk is an inherent part of space, and that makes it very challenging. So I think all these ingredients make the space industry a very different industry.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. You're mentioning risk. We Europeans have our issues with risk as opposed to the Americans. So how do you see that? Are we improving here? Are we getting cooler as the space industry is evolving?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Our culture is a bit risk adverse, and space is still seen as a risky business, a bit exotic, mm. and investors in Europe are a bit shy about investing in space. But this is changing by the day. I mean, if you read the news every day, more or less, you have the announcement of a new investment fund dedicated to space or mm-hmm. space and aeronautics, or space and defense in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I meet daily new investment funds, new investors interested mm-hmm. in investing in space, which is really good news. Because I think also, I mean, what has happened in the last decade with the Elon Musks and Jeff Bezos mm-hmm. has changed the way we view space. Because now mm-hmm. we realize that space is also a place where to do benefits, where to do economic impact, where to make money, to be frank. Mm-hmm. And it's a very good place where to invest. And you get a huge return on investment if you invest in the right places. So, yes, this view of risk as a very risky game is mm-hmm. changing. And that's mm-hmm. the best thing that could happen mm-hmm. for space.
Sure, sure. So where does this investment money mainly come from? From individuals, from what kind of, from different parts of industries? So is there a specific direction investments are funneling into the space industry?
Okay, in the US, the big investment funds, the pension funds, etc., are investing in space, in defense, as a very business as usual manner. I mean, that's a mm-hmm. standard thing for them mm-hmm. to do. First of all, in Europe, we do have some large investment funds, and so far they have been a bit shy at looking into the space business. But what I see is that many large investment funds, which are, investing in more routine, but more traditional investment areas, are now starting to develop their own smaller technology-related fund. So now mm-hmm. they look into real deep tech areas, high tech, etc. And of course, space is a part of it. Mm-hmm. So they kind of diversify themselves. And they developed some smaller funds, which are targeting high-tech areas and space in particular. Mm-hmm. So that I see as a trend now in the investment landscape in Europe. Now, of course, you may ask, but where do they invest in space? Because space is many things. You have, of course, the space infrastructure. You have the launchers, the space stations, etc. You have the services that space delivers. And most of the time, they will invest in services, applications of space, what we can do with space data. But there is also, and that is also a recent feature, the development of an economy around low Earth orbit or exploration. Mm-hmm. And the sector of exploration in general, including space stations, including going to the moon with, in the future, landers, but also men mm-hmm. going back to the moon, starts to become a commercial sector as well. And this is a very...
You mentioned you're a space geek. Do you watch The Expanse? So have you watched all the seasons so far? Are you a science fiction buff?
I read science fiction.
Okay.
I can tell you that I think my favorite film in terms of space is The Martian, because I...
It seems like it's realistic, isn't
it? It's totally realistic. It was actually, I mean, totally. No, I'm exaggerating.
Hollywood realistic.
Better, much better than that. Because mm-hmm. what is not realistic is the wind thing. There is no wind in Mars like they see it, at least not enough to overturn an antenna. But the rest is quite realistic. And NASA collaborated with them on the scenario. So mm-hmm. yes, it was checked. The most realistic film, and also a film that I adore, is Apollo 13. Wow. But this is not science fiction. This is true, true, true.
I'm still getting goosebumps by just you mentioning it.
It's fantastic.
It's fantastic. You have a master's degree in propulsion and chemistry, if I'm informed correctly, but also in political sciences. So, so what kind of strange combination is that?
Well, as I mentioned, I love rockets. So, you know, mm-hmm. anything that makes noise, that makes sound, that makes fire, I find very fascinating. So that was, as an engineer, that was my field of expertise long time ago. But still, I still watch with lots of interest the developments in the launcher industry and the propulsion industry. Mm-hmm. By the way, not many things have changed since I studied in these sectors. We are still using classic propulsion techniques for most of our engines, except mm-hmm. for the smaller engines where we have electric propulsion. But okay, this was a side remark. Mm-hmm. Why political sciences? Because next to engineering, I'm very interested in history and in particular the story of Europe and how Europe developed itself as a, you know, as a construction from the end of the 19th century to now. And that was my subject. And I must say at ESA, I am the happiest person on earth because I have both the European building up, mm-hmm. a concrete application of Europe, and of mm-hmm. course, space.
I'm hoping everyone just heard that this is a dream place to work at, I guess.
Oh, it is. It is, absolutely. I come back from 3 days meeting in our technical center in Noordwijk in the Netherlands. Well, first of all, it's great to have meetings in places such as ESTEC, our technical center, because you are where things happen. I mean, in headquarters, we do documents and, you know, sign contracts. But there we have labs, we have test facilities. This is great. You have this number of people from all nationalities. You know, I have I think I have 19 nationalities in my team. And, it's fantastic. I mean, we all work together, speak together, of course, with different backgrounds and cultures, but this makes it even better. It's really great.
What was the most moving moment to you personally when it comes to the space industry? Maybe a rocket launch, something else. What was the most moving one?
No, it was, there is no doubt there. It was Philae landing.
Yes.
It was the best ever. And you know, it's something when, I mean, myself, I was crying like a baby. But, you know, when you see all these seasoned engineers who have spent decades working on that mission, and they are crying and hugging each other, and our DG was crying, and you know, it's so emotional. It's something mm-hmm. because it's literally 20 years of work
Yes.
That are being played, you know, that you don't know if it will work out, and you have no clue. And the thing has traveled mm-hmm. so far. Will it continue to function properly, etc.? Mm-hmm. It was so emotional.
Why does the audience, does the public not see that emotional image of Isa? Because if we take a look at, you mentioned Elon Musk. So whatever he does, you have cameras on everything. You have cameras on Elon running out of the control room and dashing into the open, watching the rocket launch. So what is it about us, about Isa, that we are sort of a little bit shy to show emotions?
Well, first of all, I think you mentioned risk and the US and Europe. You can say that about emotions too. We are more, I mean, as Europeans, I think we tend to show more, to show less our emotions than the Americans do. But this emotional part is very present in the space business. It's true we don't show it enough, although there again, I think things are changing because you do see, I mean, for events such as Rosetta, but there will be others. There will be Ariane 6 first launch. There will be the JUICE mission to mm-hmm. Jupiter. There will, and I can bet that you will see lots of emotions mm-hmm. in the room, in the control centers, etc., because these are also extremely challenging missions.
But I think we will need cameras there also. And what I was trying to point at is maybe a little bit of criticism that ESA is not like really welcoming the eyes of the public at the center of where things are happening. And maybe I'm a filmmaker. I'm a science filmmaker. And so I maybe have a little bit of a different view on things, especially when it comes to science communication. So science communication very often works best if you can transfer that spark of emotion, that spark of inspiration between the lay people, the lay audiences, and the experts. Because usually lay audiences do not really understand, as myself, how a rocket works. But what we feel, what we understand is the emotion behind the engineer. So if we draw that connection, if we can bridge that gap, I think we do a great job for science communication. So my question would be, why is ESA falling behind that kind of openness?
Mm. Well, I'm sure this is changing, first of all. And it is true that ESA has been a place of, you know, as I said, very an engineering place. So we are talking mm-hmm. serious matters. We are not allowed to joke too much around the job. We should, you know, it's also in general, the US is more at ease with expressing fears mm-hmm. and also coping with risks and coping with failures. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Elon Musk. I've always been struck by the fact that, I mean, he has suffered many failures with his launches, many of them successive failures. But every time he was saying, now we will improve. Thanks to this failure, we will learn, we will improve.
Yes.
In Europe, when we have a failure, it's a catastrophe. We are mm-hmm. all head down, very, you know, very sad. But
sure.
we don't see the positive side of the failure that allows you to indeed improve your product. And we tend to, you know, stop there and I'm quite sure in Europe, a launcher that would have suffered the number of failures that the Falcon launcher has suffered
sure.
would have been stopped.
Sure, absolutely. But the strange thing is to me, I mean, if you ask your colleagues behind closed doors, I think everyone would say to the question, how do we learn? How do humans learn? Everyone would say by making mistakes.
Of course, of course. That's
but in
the
public,
only way.
In public, we're not saying it.
No, but it's there again, it's changing. And I think the new space is helping us because that's how the startups function. And by the way, the emotional side, the funny side, the fact that you can, you know, reach to different audiences is also a thing that the new space development is bringing to us. When I see the startups, they are all, I mean, many of them are young students or young professionals. And they talk to their colleagues from the non-space sector. They reach out to them. It's incredible what they do. And they are so used to going to the networks also. You mentioned reaching out to wider audiences. You have seen Thomas Pesquet, Matthias Maurer.
Sure.
They are now experts at going on social media and reaching to much larger audiences than any astronaut before. And
yes,
also to the youth, because this is very important. And you are right. I for instance, my own experience is I've been intervening several times in the high schools of my daughters. And when I talk about space, I talk mostly about the emotions and the joy of working in this multicultural European environment with people who are highly gifted at what they do, but they are working with one goal. And this is extremely strong, and they understand that, even if they are not mathematicians or physicists.
Sure. Is the European space industry sufficiently equipped with young people coming into the field?
That is an issue in Europe. We have seen that there are not enough students in engineering, in mathematics, in scientific, and especially not enough girls, by the way. And
problem.
Yes, and I want to highlight that because I think diversity is also a diversity of genders. It's also a richness to have this diversity. So yes, we have to do more, and space can help because space is so attractive. I mean, I see that when I go to talk in schools or universities, space is still the most attractive topic you can talk about. I mean, if you talk, you know, physics, if you talk, it's nice, it's
sure,
challenging. But when you apply it to space, when you say, now we are going to understand how the universe has evolved and how it has developed, and we're going to see if we can find the evidence of black holes,
sure,
of gravitational waves, this makes a difference. So we can attract young people to science with space.
Sure. And I think this would be part of great communication. And of course, this is also something we're lacking globally, a reworking, a rekindling of education, the educational system. So this would be a beautiful example of good communication to give physics, to give the quote unquote hard sciences, hard disciplines, a grander narrative. So you do not study physics for maybe its own sake. Some do. But most will do it for something else. And the grander narrative is to make spacecraft go to Mars, to bring people to wherever. So that grander narrative is maybe something that could attract people into the field to swallow the bitter pill, if you will, studying physics, math, and whatnot. Of course, it's not a bitter pill, but to some it is.
Yes, and I did have a physics teacher when I was in high school who was, instead of, you know, solving equations, he was giving examples. And I remember he was giving an example about the Apollo capsule and how it, the physics of the return to Earth of the Apollo capsule. And that made it fascinating.
Yes.
I think that
yes,
was part of what brought me to space, actually.
Have you watched that great YouTube video with that physics teacher demoing inertia with his concrete ball hanging from the ceiling?
No, I haven't. But so I will.
You should. So he would set up a concrete ball hanging from the ceiling. He would walk towards the end of the room and hold the ball right in front of him, in front of his face. And then he would let it go and wait for it to bounce back. So it would have crushed his face if physics didn't work.
That's brave.
yeah. It's brilliant. It's really brilliant. So let's jump to a completely different topic, because the Russia-Ukraine situation has also brought some consequences into ESA. Are the Russians missing in ESA to you?
Oh, that's a complex question. Of course, we were dependent on Russia because we were cooperating with Russia. So when you cooperate, you are interdependent.
Sure.
And we had a substantial cooperation with Russia on launchers. You know, they were launching the Soyuz launcher from Guyana, but also on science with the ExoMars mission, and also other lunar missions. And we have, by the way, some Russian instruments on Boeing missions. So, yes, I think in any case, Russia is a very large space power, and it has been a long-standing partner. So we are missing Russia in that sense very much. And I have hope that that eventually, when this war is over and we have a peaceful, and I hope the sooner the better, situation, we will be able to rebuild partnership and cooperation. I think, also, I do believe that, in a way, politics should not interfere in science in particular.
Absolutely.
I think science is a world
no
of
borders.
Its own. Yes. And so, yes, we are hardly hit by this war. It has a strong impact on the launching of our missions and also on our ExoMars mission, I would say, mostly.
Of course, you know that joke, a decade-old joke about the million-dollar space pen being developed by the Americans and the Russians, and the Americans invested millions in a writing tool for space, and the Russians just used a pencil. So, in your experience at ESA, do Russians work differently? Is this just a joke, or is the Russian way to do things the efficiency by improvisation, is that a real thing?
Improvisation, I wouldn't say is their way of working, but I think they are very pragmatic people, and they make gradual improvements of proven developments. So in fact, the Soyuz launcher is the same as some 50 or 60 years ago. It has been, of course, improved with, in particular, anything that has to do with computers and so on. But there is, let's say, the U.S. Are perhaps more into very radical technology change, and perhaps the Russians are more pragmatic. But these are a bit of a cliche, I would say. And by the way, the U.S. did develop the rollerball in order to ride in space, as you know. And this has been a huge commercial success ever since.
Yes.
So they did have a return on their investment.
Yes, but it still makes a good joke. Geraldine, you are the director of commercialization. And that sounds maybe a little strange to ESA, because the origin of ESA was not in the commercial sector. So finally, are we getting ESA t-shirts now at H&M?
No. And by the way, I'm always a bit sad when I see all the European young people with NASA sweatshirts all over. There is a very good ESA space shop, if you want. It's on the internet, but it's not in H&M. This being said, commercialization is not about commercialization of the ESA trademark.
Yes.
It is about supporting, European technology, European ideas, concepts, becoming marketable products and becoming eventually commercial successes. This is what it is about. And mostly, of course, startups, newcomer entities. What we want is to build the unicorns of tomorrow in space. And we have a lot of tools to do that, from business incubation centers, partnering with investors, opening up our facilities to the startups, and also providing in-orbit demonstration or in-orbit validation opportunities. So there are many things that we can do to support the development of this European new space. And this is what we are doing.
Sure. Is there a very concrete example, maybe a current example or something you would like to share that helps us understand what that kind of commercialization means?
Yes, I mean, there are many things. I can give you a few examples. There is, for instance, a Finnish, it was a startup, now it's becoming a larger company. It's not even an SME anymore, called ISAI. And it started with two students in the Helsinki University, which were developing a radar. And now it's a company that makes constellations of small satellites, small radar satellites, and they are selling to the entire world because they do a very good product, cheap, at least much at a much lower cost than usual larger satellites, and which is complementary to the existing flying missions. So ISAI from Finland, you have, for instance, in France, you have companies like ExoTrail or Venture Orbital Systems or Loft Orbital. Loft Orbital is a Franco-American company. So these companies are active in developing small electric engines for satellites, which is, of course, first of all, a green propulsion, mm-hmm. but also a lighter propulsion way. So this is a very efficient one. You have also, I was mentioning Loft Orbital. They do in-orbit validation opportunities. And there are many, I mean, there are so many areas where these startups are active, and they are not replacing, they are complementing what is being done with the more traditional industry. What I think is most fascinating with those new companies, also in launchers, you see so many mm-hmm. Small launchers developing now in Germany. You have ISAR, High Impulse, RFA, yeah. etc. I think what is really nice is that when I was a student, wanted to work in space, you had not much choice. You had to go to the large companies or you had to go to the space agencies. Now you can do your own satellite as a student and you can mm-hmm. launch your own company and become very successful commercially and live from it. This is, the barrier of going to space has been lowered considerably. And this, I think, is fantastic. And I want to come back to a question you raised. Mm-hmm. Why is ESA now going to the commercial side of business? First of all, we go to the commercial side of business since a long time. I mean, mm-hmm. we have, we develop payloads in the telecommunications industry in partnership with operators, in partnership with companies. So we are active, of course, in launchers, and launchers are a commercial business. In Earth observation also, we support the development of services based on Earth observation data. So ESA is already undertaking, let's say, commercial developments, so to speak. But mm-hmm. what was missing, and what I think our DG wants to promote, is first of all, a transversal approach, more visibility to commercialization, a more coherent approach, and a focus on new and emerging markets. And all the companies that I mentioned to you earlier, the new startups, they are on completely new markets. And this is also mm-hmm. very interesting.
What is ESA's role in the international space sector? So do you see the international space sector a globalized sector where each player or each nation or combination of nations has its own role in a bigger picture? Or is everyone doing everything and trying to compete with each other?
It's a mixture. Mm-hmm. Space has, I think, since the outset, been a mixture of cooperation and competition. When mm-hmm. when you look at the beginnings of the space era with the kind of space war, I would say, between yeah. the US and USSR, even then, very quickly, you had cooperation. You had the Apollo-Soyuz mission in the 1970s. So already there was this embryo of cooperation. And mm-hmm. also from the beginning, you had cooperation on science. And there mm-hmm. has always been. So space is really a sector, I would say a multiple sector, where you have cooperation on science, on certain applications. For instance, weather forecasting is done at international level among the different agencies. They cooperate. They share the mm-hmm. data of the satellites. Mm-hmm. The space station is a typical example of cooperation among many sure. space powers. But you also have competition in services, in commercial launches, etc. And the industry, of course, space industry, is competing against each other. Now, what is new also is the fact that space used to be a public-funded sector mm-hmm. mostly. Now it is becoming a public and private-funded sector. And now we see the private investments in space are now, for instance, worldwide, they are even larger than the European budgets dedicated to space. Mm-hmm. So private space investment is a new fact, and it is growing very rapidly, much more rapidly than the public space investment. Mm-hmm. So I think we are getting to a time when space will be a mixture of public and private funded endeavors. Mm-hmm. So international cooperation will continue. I have no doubt. I'm absolutely convinced that if humans go to Mars, it will be in an international mission. But this international mission could well be a mixture of private parts and public funded parts.
Sure. In the face of what SpaceX are doing, for example, when it comes to launchers, will there be a realistic chance for an Ariane 7 in the future at all? Does it make sense to do something like this anymore?
Oh, yes, it does. It does. It does. First of all, we have Ariane 6, and then we will have Ariane 7. Yeah. I think certainly the Ariane 7 will be, I have no doubt, a reusable launcher, perhaps with different propulsion means. I mean, this would mean different engine developments, which, as you know, I will look at closely. But it's also new ways of production. It's also new materials. So, yes, there is room for an Ariane 7 because, in any case, Europe needs autonomy in launchers. And I think if the Russian and Ukraine situation has demonstrated something, is that we cannot live without European-developed launchers available when we want. And therefore, we will always need to have a European launcher, or I would say actually several European launchers, because I believe we need a range of launchers from heavyweight to small launchers. So we will certainly develop Ariane 7 and others.
I would like to come back to a topic that is dear to my heart, that is outreach and that is public communication. Is there any strategy that you're also supporting when it comes to commercialization? Because this is not a stranger to outreach. So it's in its vicinity, maybe, to bring the public closer to what the space industry is all about. Because, I mean, like, there's such great momentum already in it. So how can we bring the public to the next level, especially in Europe?
Yes. Well, there are many, let's say, layers of strategy and communication on that. Certainly the use of social networks. I mean, you see how active the new space companies are on Twitter, LinkedIn. I mean, you were mentioning Elon Musk. Twitter, he's a master. But all our European startups are also very good at that, and I try to get into it as well. But more important than that, we have lots of events such as hackathons. We have prizes. We have, we have new types of space conferences. Also, with the COVID, we have increasingly resorted to the use of virtual events, and this works quite well. So yes, new space is a lot about reaching out, because they need to also to attract potential investors, and they need to demonstrate their interest, and the investors need to see that they are present and they have an audience and they have a market, more importantly. So yes, you are right. This is a new word which is much more used already from the outset to this outreach.
Geraldine, if your phone rang right now and your director general was on the phone and said, hey, we have a secret Mars mission that's launching tomorrow. You should be on board. What would you say?
I'd say, when do we go? When should I get my suit on?
So you'd be ready to do the real thing. So you're not just confined to your office. You'd be ready to do something.
I've done a number of parabolic flights. I've done four of them.
Wow. So is it the vomit comet for real? Or how was that to you?
Well, that's what I can say. I didn't vomit. So I'm ready to go. I don't have space sickness. It's great. Actually, you should do it. It's fantastic. Experiencing weightlessness is just fabulous.
So where are those places where people could enjoy weightless flights?
Well, we have a European service. It's called Novespace, and you can buy tickets for a parabolic flight. It costs 5,000 or 6,000 euros, so it's expensive, but it's not. I mean, but if you really want to do, exactly, you can do it. You can You can save a bit and go for it. It's worth it.
Maybe I can be open about my age. I'm turning 50 next year. So maybe if someone hears that out there, or maybe my family, 6,000 euros, that's okay. That's a good investment.
Yes.
So I'd be up for a parabolic flight next year.
Excellent.
But Geraldine, speaking of going into space, do you have an estimate which generation of humans will live in space for good? Are we seeing such a generation on the horizon, or is this still very much science fiction?
I wouldn't say science fiction, but I don't see that it will be the generation of my children, shall we say, those who are in their early 20s. I think they will certainly be the ones to go to Mars. So already it's a fantastic perspective, and they will, of course, be the ones that return to the moon, and even those which are in their 30s. You know, we recruit new astronauts, by the way. Ongoing recruitment of astronauts. They will be the first Europeans to walk on the moon. That is for sure. They might be the ones who go to Mars. It might be the generation after them. I think settling down permanently in space is more towards the end of this century. So it's already a different generation.
So mentioning personnel for future space missions, so if our audience is now looking for new ways to spend their lives with, what are you looking for? What is the space industry looking for?
The space industry is looking for all types of engineers, technicians, scientists in all sectors, all of them. I mean, mechanics, electricity, information technology, electronics, you name it. I mean, there is a job for
everyone.
Everyone. We also need lawyers. We also need economists, administrators. And that's what I also say to young people. If you really want to work in space, but you are not good in science, that's not an issue. You can work in a different manner. And there are all types of jobs. Of course, we need medical doctors, as you can imagine. And I would say as astronauts, what we look for is there we look for scientific disciplines, but it can be biology, it can be physics, it can be any type of scientific discipline. And I would say we look for people who are extremely flexible, extremely solid psychologically, in very good health, quite sportive, and who, I think most importantly, who can work as a team. That is the most important, I think, for an astronaut, is the ability to work in a team manner.
Does it still take that or employ that cliche that astronauts need to be physical super soldiers? Or has that changed also in the past years?
No, that has changed. Because I don't think you need to be a physical super soldier to go to space. In space, you don't have much effort, physical effort to do. Mm. But you need to be a brain that can do many things differently and adapt very rapidly. Because you will be called, if you are in a space station, to do lots of different things during the day. So you need to be able to change quickly from one activity to the other.
Yes. Geraldine, off the top of your head, what are you most looking forward to when it comes to the space industry? Maybe space missions. What is it that produces goosebumps immediately when you think about it?
Goosebumps is, the future launches. So goosebumps would be the moment we do have a European-developed reusable launcher, and we see it landing back like we see nowadays the SpaceX ones. And the second goosebump, I think, would be a European on the moon, definitely. And in terms of scientific excitement, I leave it to you to choose, because there are so many of our science missions coming up, which will do, JUICE, Euclid, Plato. We have a range of science excitements. But I would say, yes, reusable launcher, European on the moon.
When is that happening, the European on the moon?
It could happen by the end of this decade.
Fascinating.
So soon.
So very soon. That's like almost tomorrow.
Yeah.
In in space terms. Geraldine, at the end of our show, we have a question we keep asking our guests. And that is the question, why don't you share an espresso for the mind with us? A piece of inspiration that you imagine could be an inspiration, a shot of energy to me, to the audience.
I can think of several. I can think of writers such as Richard Feynman. He was a very famous physicist, and he was what I most value about him. He was not afraid of doing completely different things from what was expected from a scientist. And actually, he taught that, he got that from his first wife, who told him, "You should go your own way and don't care about what other people think." And she even printed that on, I think, 100 pencils. What do you care what other people think? And I think that's a very important thing I always say also to youngsters, to students, etc. Go your way. Don't bother about what other people think. If you have ambition, if you want to go far, you will. But just don't bother with what other people think.
That's very powerful. Geraldine, thank you so much for your time. That was highly inspiring.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, a real pleasure, actually.
Thank you, all of you out there, for spending time with me today. I hope I could add a little extra to your day, as do all the countless podcasts I have in my personal daily diet. Hey, I'd totally love to hear from you where you listen to the Space Cafe podcast. Running, shopping, exercising, at work? Get in touch on LinkedIn or spacewatch.global and let me know. All right, I'm off for today. We're preparing a fancy giveaway soon. Stay tuned. Bye-bye. Uh-huh.